state your name and your birthday again.
Okay, my name is Carol Lester. I was born October 8th, 1939, here in La Grande, Oregon. And I graduated from high school here in 1957.
Were you born in the hospital here?
Yeah, I was born in the old St. Joseph Hospital.
The old St. Joseph Hospital. Then when you started school, where did you start to school?
Well, I went to Riveria. They had seven grades there. I went through the seventh grade at Riveria, and then they had the new high school was built, I think, probably in the early 50s, 53 or so. So I went to eighth and ninth grade in old high school, and then the sophomore through senior year, I went to the present high school, graduated there in 57.
And where were you living at the time you were going to Riveria?
My folks were living on 2502 North Ash Street, here in La Grande.
And you lived there most of the time?
Well, I lived there until I was, I was there when I was a junior, and then I think the later that spring when I was a senior, we moved down on Russell Street.
Uh-huh. And that was across the tracks, and then you would walk up to the high school when you were in the high school.
Yeah, we'd always, when on our way to school, we always walk through the yards, right through the roundhouse yards over that wooden bridge they had across the main line tracks or all the tracks by the ice house. And then we went up that way.
And what did your father do during that?
My father was a machinist in the roundhouse, worked for the railroad as a machinist.
While you were going to grade school over there, was anything particularly happened that you enjoyed doing, games you played?
We always had kind of like sandlot football, baseball, basketball. We did all that, and then there was always certain times of the year. Couldn't tell you the exact times, but the Navajo Indians would come in on these big steel gangs, and they'd have the softball games going over there across from the city shops where they got it's all fenced in now, but they play soccer on now, but at that time it was all cinders. Mm-hmm. And so they'd let us kids go in there and play with them. They was pretty good about letting us play with them, and we couldn't understand a lot of them. Once in a while one would speak English, but it was all in Navajo, most of it.
Well, I didn't know about that. That's very interesting. Mm-hmm. Then when you got into high school, what, did you take in sports?
Yeah, I played sports, all of them, track and some basketball and a little bit of baseball. And football was the main thing I liked to play. And at least when I was a senior in high school, not very many people credited to us, but we had a good winning team that year. We won six, tied two, and lost one. But we didn't go to state. We tied them, but we got beat by another team that kind of eliminated us. But if we would have won all the games, we should have. Even though we tied Pendleton, we would have got to go.
It was quite competitive during that period of time.
Oh, yeah.
Particularly with Baker.
Oh, yeah. Baker was really a big deal. So was Pendleton. Actually, those two were real good rivals.
Uh-huh. In going to school, what did you take up that you thought you were going to use when you got out of school?
Well, I really never got too much into the sciences. I didn't have a real good program in that, or electronics either. I would have liked to have got further into that, but they only had one course in it. They didn't offer anything to, you know, like they would today, probably. I don't know what they do today, but the rest of it, you know, it was kind of a trial and error thing after I got out to work to learn what I did know about electronics, but I would have liked to have had a good education in it.
I can appreciate that. Then, when you graduated from high school, did you know what you wanted to do?
No, I didn't really know what I was. You know, jobs were kind of hard to find. You could get farm work and stuff like that. And I really was still, like a lot of kids, still trying to make my mind up. I was 17 because my birthday, I went to high school, I was 17 years old and I graduated. So, really didn't know. I thought a lot of things wouldn't be here, like sawmills and all that. The way times were tough then, too. And I went to work for the county and sprayed weeds. And then I went to college for a couple of semesters. And then after that, I worked for Valsetts Lumber Company up at Pondosa. They were logging back in that country in there. And I drove the water truck. I watered roads. So I get out. Had to get up early in the morning and spend daylight to dark watering roads. And usually catch a logging truck in and a logging truck the last one out.
When did you buy your first car?
Well, when I was a senior in the spring of when I was a senior in high school.
What kind of a car was that?
Well, it was a 49 Chevy. And I had one other car, a couple other ones that was my granddad when he died. He gave me, I had an old 40 or 41 four-door Plymouth, and I sold it and had a Model A pickup that I got down here. I got down here from Bill Herman when he's running a service station. I think he was down here on where that Oak Street Exxon is. I think it was that was who it was that owned it, but anyway, I bought it from him. It had a wooden canopy on the back. I got paid $75 for it, and the guy I wanted it, so I said, well, you can have it for $150, and I said, it's yours. I really thought I made a good deal there. Hadn't had it a year, and that's about it.
You could always sell a Model
A. Yeah, I wished I still had it, yeah. I had one other Plymouth that was like a 29 Plymouth that I got after I'd bought my first car, and an old painter out here painted houses or something. I don't know what the guy's name is, a coupe. And he had a thing on the side where he carried the ladder, but it had an oval mirror in the back, and it had a first 29 Plymouth. It had hydraulic brakes. It was one of the first cars that ever had them, I think, is what I've understood. And anyway, when I got married, my dad kept saying, this is getting to be like a used car lot around here. You got to do something with these cars. So I sold it to my uncle for $35.
Well, how did you meet your wife? Say she went to school with Elgin?
Well, yeah, she went to school with Elgin, and I was actually just going to, we used to do have a lot of dances on Friday and Saturday night up around Elgin, and was been going to a lot of them, and I met her at a dance over there. I don't remember, 1959, I think it was.
You said when you were in high school that Mrs. Burns was your student teacher, and then she taught your wife at Elgin?
Yeah, Mrs. Burns, she was my student teacher in English class I had here when I was a senior in high school. The class she had was, the other teacher that taught it was Ida McKayley, and she was the one that did the student teaching for her there. And then I met her again after I met my wife, because she had, of course, that was 1957 when I met Mrs. Burns, and then after I met my wife in 59 and I got acquainted with her again, when she was teaching school as a regular English teacher over there, and my wife really, really liked her. All of her girlfriends and stuff, they really thought a lot of her. And then I met her again after we were married over, and she was teaching in Hermiston. It was the early 60s or mid-60s or something like that. It was in the 60s anyway. So we lived there in Hermiston about 62, I guess we lived there for a while and we moved here again. We went back over in 64, and I know it was in like 64 or 5 that she was there when we went on to her again.
When did you first get interested in the signal department?
Well, I got laid off from the road crew up at Valsetts Lumber Company in this summer of 59. It was in the fall of 59. And bought a car, and I was thinking about going into service, and then I had to pay for it some way, you know. It was a 57 Chevy, you know, everybody had to have one. And so I knew a friend of mine, Linda Hodge. Her dad was a clerk up there in the roadmaster's office, and she says, John Hodge. She says, Dad says they're hiring up there, go up and see him, but she didn't tell me where. And so what I did, it was a temporary job on the section. I worked 6 weeks relieving the section. Man, that was going on a vacation. Mainly I was out of Talcasset. Section foreman at that time was Milt Bowers. And so anyway, after that 6 weeks was up in the first part of November, they said, well, they went to John. He said, well, they're hiring signal people up at up on the Washi. And I said, well, might as well go. You know, so I went and...
Washi was the line between...
It was the line between Spokane and Hinkle.
Uh-huh.
And so then I went to work up there for Frank Engstrom, the signal foreman at the time. And then we stayed down a siding called Page, and that was before... I was on the Snake River, and that was before we... We hadn't relocated any track or any signals or anything. It was, the water was still normal flow on the Snake. And what we did is they made shoe flies and stuff so they could, we had to move pole line out of the way.
No,
and
shoe
all
fly
that.
Was...
Well, a shoe fly pole line is the same thing as like making a temporary road somewhere where you can go temporarily. Basically is what it is. So that's what we did. And then,
That was kind of like an apprentice during that
Yeah,
time.
I was a signal helper, yeah. I was just, that's what the, we had three classes, signal helper, assistant signalman, and signalman. That was the, and I was a signal helper at that time. And then in, it was about January of 1960, we moved to Spokane, our signal gang did. And what they were doing was they had a In fact, that whole Washi had nothing but semaphore signals on it. And the reason they wanted them out of there because they were two-position type signals. They, you know, the ones with the blades on them, they call them the red board, the yellow boards, and so forth. And so they wanted to get them out of there, and we went to what they call an automatic permissive block system. It was just color light system. And it also, the pole line up there was square cedar poles and falling down, so we rebuilt the pole line and came down to what we did is we worked our way down from Spokane to Ayer, Washington, and that's where you meet the Snake River, and they got what they call a high bridge that crosses the Snake River near that point, and that's one of the longest bridges in the United States, Trestle Bridge for Railroad. It's about a mile long, and at that time it was the deepest drop point on it. The middle of the bridge is 290 feet, some odd feet. And it was quite a thrill to meet a train on there because we had cable. Well, they had open cross arms on there, and then we hung a cable across there to replace that rather than try to hang extra wire, line wire out on those arms, alley arms they had on there. It was a little spooky. So then we, I'm trying to get back where I was at. Anyway, we worked down there. We had two or three other signal gangs that would work. One would, what we do, we was the last gang down. We would call the hookup gang, which we would in hook up the cables and check the wiring out and test all the signals and get ready for a cutover. And then when we'd get caught up, we'd go bill and pole line, we'd dig holes and stuff like that. And then they had another gang ahead of us that actually did the pole line and burying the cable. But if we caught up with them through cutovers, why we do this, whatever had to be done.
Well, did you install the relays and things in those little silver metal houses along the track?
Yeah, we did all kinds of that, yeah.
A lot of that equipment came from Canada, did it not?
Well, no. Yeah, a lot of this equipment was all union switch and signal. UP was really a fan of union and switch signal type signal systems. They like the, and the relays that are mostly that, yeah, they're union switch and signal relays.
When we put in the CTC from LeGrand to Huntington, I know many of those relays came from Canada.
Probably did. They may have had a manufacturing point there that they got them out of it. It's very possible. I don't know. But there's nothing on there that I've ever seen or can remember in Canadian.
When did you progress from the lower position on this alignment?
Well, I got the bid. You had to bid these jobs in, and I bid a job in on Ben Dorrington's gang, and he was down along Humerus, down in the lower part of the Snake River.
And this was all seniority?
Yeah, all seniority bidding, you know. And
the signal department was different than the trainmen. because the signal department went from Portland to Huntington and from Hinkle to Spokane.
Yeah, they had different districts, but we covered what they call a whole division, which the Oregon Division is what we were called, and that encompassed Washington and Oregon, but not Idaho, because Idaho was a separate division.
Well, some of the people wouldn't understand the difference between their trainmen and, the signal department.
No, it's different. I couldn't even explain all the trainmen stuff. I don't know how they keep track of it themselves. But, I bid that assistant signalman's job in, and I don't know what, the time frame only is in the 60s, 61 or so. And then you had to do that in order to get your date. You didn't want to miss out on somebody running around you, because that's what would happen, because then if you bid on a signalman's job, and even though you hired out before him and he beat you on an assistant's date, you're going to be way behind when you get the position of signalman class. That's your class. Yeah, you want to keep your seniority right with you as you go. And
at that time, they still had the dispatcher's office in LeGrand.
Yeah, at that time, they still had the dispatching office in LeGrand. They had what they call east and west dispatchers there. One was LeGrand to, I think at that time I started as LeGrand to Hinkle. And the east one went from LeGrand to Huntington.
And later it changed to Nampa.
Yeah, later on they encompassed, what happened was in 1967 they moved the LeGrand dispatching office to Portland, Oregon, consolidated it there because we had we did quite a bit of CTC work between Hinkle and Portland. And then they brought in Nampa from Huntington to Nampa to Portland, and then they took what was at Nampa to Pocatello. They kept it down at Pocatello.
Uh-huh. And when you say CTC, that's stood for Centralized
Traffic Control.
Uh-huh.
That's what those when they consolidate their dispatchers, they use that to that's control on the traffic of your train, routing your trains, clearing the signals for them, moving the switches, and you eliminated the train order board stuff.
The dispatcher watched the board, and he could actually track the train on the track from those division points.
Yeah, they track this. That's what the centralized traffic control is. You got the dispatching center, which tracks your train, and that's done through the activation of track circuits and different things, that apparatuses along the track where they can track the train to see what worries between what siding, between what switches. They can line a power switch over the siding and it'll tell whether it's line normal or reverse. They can clear a signal over the switch and wrap the train one direction or the other over the switch.
Did your trainmen then, they called in by radio or telephone? How were they communicating with the dispatchers?
Well, at that time they had a phone signal houses to communicate with. When I first started, they didn't get the radio. They started a little radio dispatching there in LeGrand just before they moved it to Portland, but it wasn't it worked, but the whole networks of the Union Pacific communication system wasn't, it was just in its infancy phase, I know one of the concerns at the time of Harold Stratton, who was the assistant signal engineer, or chief signal engineer at that time, he made a decision that when they got in Portland that they would use the microwave to communicate back and forth and to talk on, plus use our coding equipment over over that too. And they say he was, at that time they thought it was a big risk. The main reason that is that you don't want to have downtime, lose your dispatching system where you can't track trains anymore. Mm-hmm. The physical line's what we always used, and that way, we knew that worked.
Well, in the old days, they had an operator at each of these little depots.
Mm-hmm.
They had a hoop out there, and they gave a lineup, and you were meeting right with the dispatcher, and he told you where something was going to meet you.
Yeah, you got your train orders, and you picked up, you got your information and that way, whether you're going to make a meet at a certain place, and if you needed pickups to get a boxcars or something, you got that information too. Or in slow orders, you know, other kind of stuff that was going on, work trains and stuff where they have gangs working, track gangs working, they probably had a slow order situation somewhere, and they'd tell them what milepost it was at, what speeds and all that. They knew all of their, they'd tell them what speed to travel and all that stuff.
Well, once they got most of the mechanical work out on the road done, did you bid in a signalman job then?
Yeah, I did. I bid a signalman's job in, actually, on a, Don Blint was his name. I bid it, got my signalman's date with him. We was doing some signal pole line work. I know he was putting in switch heaters up here on the mountain. That's when that was. And I can remember that, you know, that November. I made it in September of the same year that John Kennedy was assassinated, because we was down in November. We was down at a sighting at Huron when we heard that information the dispatcher told us over the phone that he'd been assassinated. I think that was 1963, if I remember right. And then from there on, I bid back on Frank Engstrom's gang as a signalman, and we worked from on the new CTC from Hinkle to Biggs, and that was on account of the John Day Dam going in, and we were having a new main line built along the freeway, which you can see there today. All those signals you see pretty much going along the highway, I helped hang some of the cables and tested them. There was a lot of people doing it, but I did most of the...
That was relocating because, of course, the river was changing.
Yeah.
What does a signal maintainer usually do out there? What's their daily
work? Their main concern is they have federal regulations that we have to abide by. And there's several things you have to check on every month and every quarter. You make certain adjustments. And one of the things is you got to make sure your switch machine are adjusted so that they'll fail on a quarter inch gauge that's in the track. In other words, if your switch point's gapped open over a quarter of an inch, that there's a circuitry in the switch machine that allows it to put the signals to stop. That's what it's supposed to do. That's the whole idea of signaling is safety, and that's one of the things you use. It's one of your adjustment features that you do to make sure that it's, if something gets in the switch point and don't go all the way over and lock up, why then it's, you're not going to be able to clear a signal.
And you worked hand in hand with the section crew then?
Yeah.
If
the section foreman needed to be there to tamp ties or whatever it was, why, they did it, or change a rail out or switch point. If switch points, a lot of times they go chips in them and you just change them out. You know, they know when to do it, so you just, for whatever reasons like that.
There were wires connecting the rails together?
Well, we had bond wiring in along the jointed rail, and we had other connections to the rail we had to maintain all the time, make sure they was on there all the time. And there's other, you know, other, I can't really sit here and quote you all the rules because there's too many of them, but that they all had to, you know, they had to maintain the equipment we had, the apparatuses, the batteries, and so on and so forth, clean the lenses on the signals. And
but it was
so
a cooperative effort between the section and the signal maintainer to see that the road was safe for train travel.
Yeah. That was the whole idea of working together, yeah.
And a lot of the line isn't covered by highway. You had to travel it by speeder or
high rail it or something like that. We either motor car it or high rail, whichever. Most of the time, in the early days, it was all motor car. And you travel from one siding to the other that way with permission of the dispatcher.
And then there was quite a lot of rock fence. What was the purpose of rock fence?
Well, they had a lot of rock slides in this area, of course, and the idea that it could be a pretty good-sized rock come down and get in the middle of track and derail a train with a rock fence there, why it'd break the wire and then put the signals to stop on each side of this rock fence. And that way the train wouldn't, it'd stop the train, so he he could probably get his permission to go by the red signal, but he'd have to go at restricted speed, so he'd be aware to stop.
Well, that's when they called out the signal maintainer.
Yeah, usually at night. Everybody seemed like everybody was at night on those kind of things.
Did they put the propane heaters under switches during the time that you were working?
Yeah.
Before that, it was kerosene, wasn't it?
Yeah,
heaters.
It was kerosene heaters, and I know they had older. I don't remember exactly when they put the first propane heaters in. They were kind of a handmade one that the signal shop had made, and then we later on got a different, same kind of a theory, but we got a different kind of a heater in 1963. It was an open flame heater, and then later on we upgraded to what they got now, and it's a hot air blower that's run by propane. It's like a furnace in your house. You just got a big fireball and you just throw it, burns, puts heat out, and channels it down each side of the rail and melts snow.
And that cleared the ice and the snow and kept the switches working properly.
Yeah, took us out of the dark ages when it came as far as switch heaters go.
You said that you were responsible for demolishing the signal maintainer's house and the section house at Telecasa.
The signal houses is all because they had different union agreements and we didn't need the houses anymore, and then too they didn't want to keep them around, kind of property taxes. They got rid of the railroad, didn't want them standing up because they pay property tax on them. There's nobody in them. They was old houses and it was hard to upkeep, really. They was, some of them, they fixed, some of those maintainers had them fixed up pretty nice, but even I helped them with some of the internal types of people that worked on plumbing and, you know, housework.
But it was a tax thing.
Yeah, that and the union agreement, you know, that they didn't need to stay there anymore.
They lengthened the district for a signal maintainer once they got the CTC into a larger area. Can you tell about how many were before and then how many were after?
I think in this, when they had the semaphore type signaling, and their territories were about 15 miles, 12 to 15 miles, and then when they put the CTC in from Grand to Reith, then they cut that down. They cut off a few maintainers and extended the length of the territories. Could be anywhere from, say, some of it's 20 to 35 miles, just depending on what you had to maintain. You know, you, some areas in the short distance you had quite a few things to maintain, and then later on as time progresses they get longer and longer. They cut jobs off the types of technology they was getting to, you know, like I think right now they're fairly long.
You found the signal department very interesting.
Yeah, always, and it was always something different every day. I mean, you knew your work, but you still, there was always something that was come along technology-wise, or if you had other things you had over the night would happen, you have to go fix or whatever. It wasn't like going to a factory and twisting the same screws and so on, nailing the board every day. It was always just something different.
It wasn't assembly line.
No, it wasn't assembly line.
Was there anything you would like to have done better than, say, work for the signal department?
I don't think so. I don't know. I really enjoyed it. I can't think of anything. I was treated well. I had good people working with me, and I learned a lot from them and, you know, I should say, with each other, you know, and you know, it was always something to learn.
I interviewed a trainman recently, and he said it enabled him to make a living wage and to raise his family and to have a nice home. And you feel that way?
Oh, yeah. I got a good living out of it. I really don't have any complaints at all. It was a little rough when you was on the signal gangs and you had a family. It was really you had to have a good woman behind you because other, most of them, there was a lot of them that parted company with you, with their men, because it was hard, because you got a family and you might be gone all week long and come home on the weekends and hear that, you know, if you got two or three kids, you know how, if you got little ones, what that's like. And, you know, we worked our way through it, you know.
Well, working out on the outfit, you got meals through DC&H?
I never did. We never, you know, they never did. We had our outfit cars. We stayed in bunk cars, and we always packed our own grub. We had our own stoves to cook on, or a stove to cook on, and that's the way we just batched in them. You know, you could have a... If they wanted one, they would. They ask you if you wanted one, but it cost so much. We decided there wasn't enough men there to warrant one, because a lot of times, you know, on some of those older construction days where they had a lot of men working on a gang, they might have 20 men. They might have another gang beside them, and that way it would warrant having a DC&H car there to cook for you.
Well, about 1947, 48, when. I was working for, they had DC&H, but we had more men working, mm-hmm. And we lived in outfit cars, mm-hmm. Which was a box car alongside the railroad tracks, with a shower car where you could take a shower. Living in an outfit car because the train was going right by within, how many feet would you say?
Well, I don't know. Depends on where we were at. It's, I know on the Washoe there was some of them siding house tracks usually. Up there they had some short house tracks, and they would probably be 30 feet from the, 40 feet from the track. You know, it's whizzing by there in the middle of the night, and wind from the train going by kind of rock you around a little bit, plus wake you up because it's not exactly quiet.
It seemed like a telecast that was pretty close to the track.
I know there was a couple places that was up there on the Washoe that was, we was out in the middle, I can't even remember the name of Ankin. No, it wasn't some, it probably isn't even there anymore. But we were sitting out way out in the middle. Yeah, but this was on the low air there, I can't remember the name of it, because they tore it out, and that's why, you know, I don't remember the name of the place, but that's the only way. It was too far away from the town. Now you didn't have much of a choice. We did a lot of carpooling, too, when we got in different towns, you know, like we went to Hermiston and lived there. We carpooled or to get to work, and we parked down there at Rufus, and we, you know, that's about 90 miles one way, but that's worth the drive. Sleep and let the guy drive. Catch you a nap on the way back. Every day. Everybody took turns.
Well, it was a very interesting way of making a living.
Mm-hmm.
How many children did you have?
I had three. Two boys and a girl. Girls in the middle.
Most of the time, where did you live? Hermiston?
Well, we lived at Hermiston for, I'm trying to remember how many years. We lived there from about 1963 till 1971 or two. I can't remember. Then we came back here in 1972, I think it was. Maybe 71. I can't really remember. It was in the December time, and prior to that time, of course, the dispatchers had moved to Portland in 1967, and I was involved working on that in Portland, too. And anyway, I moved back here, and I bid a job in as a general CTC maintainer here in McGrann, but I did prior to that, I just relieved the general maintainers, the one in Portland and one in McGrann, where the two dispatching centers was. And then when I bid the one here, they didn't have the dispatching center, was gone in LeGrand, but what I did was maintain the coding apparatus in the field or control locations and things like that. And we did also worked on some hot box detectors, which we put in 1965 here in LeGrand, and I got in on that too.
What kind of box?
We call them hot box detectors. What they do is detect hot journals on box cars. They're set alongside the track at different locations to give you a readout and tell you whether what side of the car and what axle on the car was hot, and they'd set the car out.
It got very high tech, really.
Oh yeah, well that's the reason they got, one of the reasons they got rid of the cabooses was the hot box detectors and dragging equipment stuff. Modern technology has made a big splash in the railroad in the last, since 1980. Oh, and it's just progressing all the time.
Was it harder when the dispatchers moved out of La Grande and it was such a long distance?
Everything as far as controlling trains, a lot of people, trainmen probably might not say that, but it would work the same. The difference was that you didn't have the, and this is what I would miss as a trainman, is coming by the dispatching office and saying howdy and talk to a dispatcher or something like that, where La Grande was a terminal.
More of a personalized.
It was more of a personalized thing, and I think that's what I would miss it. I know I did, so I think I could speak for some of the trainmen.
You got to know all the people and...
Yeah, the trainmen, they all knew the dispatchers. Dispatchers knew them, and, you know, they kind of had some, you know, a relationship that way.
Did you ever work here when Eldon Thompson was one of the dispatchers?
Yeah, he was here working. Eldon Thompson was, and so was... Delbert Lee. He was the one, and then there
Felix
was
Cavallo.
Felix Cavallo, he was the chief dispatcher.
Did you work during the time Wayne Drummond was the
dispatcher? Yeah, he was there when I was there. I was, Don Hepburn was the other one.
Yeah.
And Jim Gary was there, and so was Cliff. And then there was one other guy, Don, his brother runs that spray place now. Don Tannehill was here. They were assistant chiefs, and the reason I kind of knew them, I relieved general maintainer at the time here was Glenn Balcom, Bud Balcom. So they had nobody to relieve them. So they asked me if I wanted to work with them, learn how to do it. And it was that was a big responsibility. I was really worried, you know, about it, because I didn't figure I ever knew it. I might not know enough, but I learned the hard way, but I did learn. And then I went to Portland, and they had a general maintainer down there in Portland, which I worked for about 2 years with him, Harold Thomas, and he really taught me a lot. Both those guys taught me a lot. I owe a lot to those two people. And there's others too that I know I learned from too. I'm not just saying, but these is where you're up on that end where you have to, you know, something goes down, you better be knowing how to fix it, because if it's going to tie your whole dispatching center up, there you are. Boy, you better be on the ball and get after it.
Well, it sounds like it was quite a situation, and the main thing for people to understand is the division had to be the whole railroad. It couldn't be just La Grande, and it had to take the whole railroad to make it work.
Yeah. Yeah, it is a team effort, basically, is the best way to look at it.
How did Hinkle work out there? It was quite a large place.
Well, see, there's another thing the signal department manages, maintains, is that classification yard over there at Hinkle. And they got all those retarders and things like that in there. It's that's.
Could you explain what a retarder is?
Well, a retarder is what it does is squeezes just like a brake when the boxcar comes over the hump hill there to go down into the bowl. They got them setting down on a kind of a grade, and as they go through it, it squeezes the wheels to slow it down. And what this all controlled by a computer. So they weigh the car, they know how much the car is, and they go and they squeeze it, and then they get the coupling speed to go down in and to couple up 4 or 5 mile an hour, so they, you get into freight damages and stuff.
So they don't have to have an engine pushing it all the way.
No.
They come up along the hump,
and they
just
cut
kind of a raised platform, and then sends the car down.
Yeah.
on the track.
I think there's somebody there that uncouples the car brakeman or something or whatever it is he's called, it, and they uncouple as they go, which they know where they want group. They got bowls and groups and tracks, you know, and they in the bowl and they designate it to go.
Is this where those sounds came from by squeezing? You know, there was a time that some of the trainmen down there, they're hearing.
Yeah, that's part of it. Yeah, that's just one of the. That's the main issue, I would imagine. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Well, I didn't understand where that sound came from, and it would be.
Yeah, if you got to wear hearing protection to go around. It's a must. It's in the safety rules, I think, to go around that place. You don't go outside without them.
Well, now I know a little bit more about that. I really didn't understand what was happening there. Mm-hmm. And then how many years did you have to work before you retired?
Well, I worked 36 years, and then during that time I was promoted to assistant signal supervisor, and then they changed that title to, in about 1986, they called us managers of signal maintenance, and they don't have that title like that anymore. But anyway, when I retired, I was the manager of signal maintenance, La Grande, Oregon, and my territory went from Echo, Oregon, to Shoshone, Idaho. It was about 400 and some miles from the main line.
Boy.
And that was that way for a couple of years. There was always merging and stuff. They were constantly changing stuff around. Now, it's changed again. The guy that's on my territory, the territory I had, there's even one less of. There was two of us out here on this end. Now there's only one, and he goes from here, I think, up to Panhandle, Idaho, and up to Washington and stuff like that. You know, a lot of territory.
You said you came from a railroad family, that your dad had worked in the roundhouse over here.
Yeah, my granddad, my dad's dad, he came from Virginia here out in this country about 1903 or 4, and went to Wawa and worked in the sawmill, and he decided he could do better down here in La Grande, and went to work the railroad in about 1907 or 8, and he retired 1944, and he had about 34 or 5 years in when he retired, and then my dad hired out.
Dad's name was?
Lynn Lester.
Lynn Lester.
He hired out in 1934 and retired in 40 years, he retired when he was 60, so I think he had about 40 or 42 years in when he retired.
Well, where was he when they removed the roundhouse from the yards out here?
Well, he was here. He never did leave. The only time he left here was Diddy's apprenticeship when I was probably about a year old. We went to Portland for about a year, 1940, and then he came back here.
Safe to say that every family around the valley here is in some way were connected to the railroad, with some member of their family working for the railroad.
Right.
And it really made the community, you might say.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I should give you that book. I got a 1925 book I got from my cousin. I copied from him. The article was totally about La Grande in 1925, and it tells you a lot of things, what the values I think it had quite a bit to say about the amount of money that each outfit made, you know, to contribute to the county, and what taxes, you know, and what the main resources were here. And it's kind of interesting if you like history. It's,
well, it is.
The thing I learned out of that thing, one of the things I learned out of that magazine, that the degree of temperature of the water out there at Hot Lake is 209 degrees, and that one, they claim, you always heard them scalding pigs out there, so-called. That's in that book.
Well, there was a lot of depots. There was even a depot at Hot Lake, and a depot at Island City in those early days.
The ones I remember that I can remember when I was over here relieving maintainers or anything, things like that. I can remember the one at, as a kid, the one there at Island City. And then the Union Junction was still going. And there's one at the Telecasset one, I can't remember. Don't may remember being one there. But the one that was one at North Powder, and there was one at Haynes, and then there was one at, the one at Durkee. I know there was one there, but I don't remember seeing it.
It wasn't very big.
And then there was the one at Huntington, which is, it was an older depot, but it was pretty good sized.
Well, it was Division Point again with the roundhouse and the yards there, which...
Yeah, there was one at Duncan, and there's one at there was one at Duncan, one at Camila. There's one at Meacham. I couldn't tell you. I mean, it was there, but the way the buildings were up there, it was hard to figure. They moved them over to one side, so I think it's where one of them is used as a youth group place at Meacham now.
A lot of history.
Yeah. A lot of it.
Did you ever have anything to do with the branch?
No, I never really. Well, the only thing we did on the branch is we had to maintain the train order boards, because up the branch, that was train order, the Joseph branch was train order board territory. And they had, at the time, there was one at Embler, but I don't think that was there too long. But I remember one very well at Elgin, and the one at Wallala, and there was one at Enterprise.
Did you ever ride the train up and go fishing?
No, I never did get to do it. No, but my father-in-law was a kid. His dad, they used to take it up there quite often and drop them off and pick them up.
Well, a lot of people did in those early days. I always thought it was interesting to ride the railroad up back. A lot of jobs have been eliminated.
Oh, yeah.
But as long as we have the hill both ways, do you think the Grand will maintain a division for your trainmen?
Yeah, unless they can figure I think they will, unless they have some other kind of a grandiose plan that we don't know about. But they're, at times they were talking about tunnels over the years, and even when I was there, they tried it again. But the way these mergers have, this is my own opinion, is the way the mergers are now with all these other railroads, that you'll probably never see a tunnel or unless there's abundance of traffic. But, right now they got quite a bit of double track when I was there, made sidings a lot longer, and so they can handle quite a load of traffic until they get to the mountainous area, and that's when it'll slow down on them. But that's the way it's been since day one, only handle so many trains in a certain area without slowing a bunch of them down.
When we removed so many sidings and things, it would almost seem like that they could have extended those sidings into double track.
Well, they did on some of them. They actually did on a couple of them.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think where they, like from Oxman, what we call it Oxman, they moved it. They call it Pritchard Creek now, and they Oxman is a siding no longer, but they moved it down where the freeway crosses the track there. The second after you cross it, and then you cross it again closer to Durkee, Pritchard Creek's right there, and they got double track from there up that horseshoe. It goes all the way around and comes up there right under the other freeway bridge, and that's what we call West Oxman. And then what they'd like to do is double track it all the way up to Pleasant Valley, and if they did that, they could have, from Encina to Pritchard Creek, they could have double track all the way. And they're really kind of a bottleneck there right now, but I don't know. They was talking about doing that when I was there, and they're still there, so I don't know if they'll ever double track that piece in there until you see it happening.
A lot of the tunnels that used to be, but they still do have that one down there by Durkee down.
Mm-hmm. The one down there, it's down there between Lyman and Weatherby.
Yeah.
Closer to Weatherby,
Right. Because there used to be one at Telecasset.
They daylighted that one.
Meacham.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, those day I was here when they daylighted all them. They daylighted. Just changed it. And up on the Washi where I first started working, they had all several tunnels, a lot of tunnels up there.
Was there any left on that stretch going to Portland?
No.
Almost?
Well, wait a minute. There is. Might be one there.
The side of the Dalles?
It might be. I haven't spent a lot of time down there, but the only one I know for sure, when I was thinking there, is because we had a derailment when I was working on a gang down there. It was out there at St. John's. They got one that it goes in from the yards, the Albany yards, it goes kind of where it comes out is, I think it's Columbia Boulevard where it comes out. And that tunnel in there is probably about half mile long, three quarter maybe. They got one there.
The railroad has really changed in the way they do business.
Oh, yeah. You know, when I was younger, I was relieved a couple of times in an interlocking plant, one in it's where all of your interchanges come from foreign railroads. You know, it's quite an operation. A guy sits in a tower and he pulls these levers to route the trains and stuff like that. You've probably seen them on some of these older movies. If you see a guy and they're pulling these levers, and there was one in Spokane, and then there was one in Portland, and on each side of the river. In fact, there's still that type of operation on the west side of the river. And there was one up in Seattle. And I never relieved the one in Seattle, but I was up there on a gang one time, but that one was an air pneumatic. The switch instead of electric switch machine moving your points over, it was air. It looked just, if you used to look at it, everything out on the track where it was pushing the switch point over to line your traffic routes, why, the only thing you heard was swoosh, and a bang, it was over there.
Yeah.
You didn't want to have your fingers anywhere close, but they had a deal device in the back of the switch machine. You'd take the cap off, and then you stick something down there, if I remember right, that it cut the air off while you was working on it. But it had lever, the tower operator, he sat up there, and he had levers and signal levers, and he'd pull all this stuff and line all the routes. See, that's gone. They did that, and I wasn't involved in it, but they did it while I was working. They got rid of that one, and the one on the east side of the river at Portland, they got rid of that in the late 80s. And there was one the one up in Spokane, I think they got rid of that too, but that was owned by the Northern Pacific or the Burlington Northern now, but we maintained it. But there's all kinds of different. There's one thing I like about the railroad or any kind of signaling. You know, there's all kinds of things that's involved in signaling. You got, like, if you have certain types of signaling out here, LeGrand to Huntington was a total different type of system. I mean, it did on the appearance of it looked the same, but the way it worked was totally different than the west of LeGrand. It was
He integrated
it's all totally different. And now when the whole eye down the new technology, the one west LeGrand, it was an old one, when they did their newer technology, they integrated it into this newer type of electronics. Does theory-wise, it's the same. Did away with a lot of pole line. You know, let's say the stock technology world we live in has changed a lot, got rid of a lot of jobs, which I don't like to see, but it's just the way it is.
Well, I used to have a lot of men on a train, and gosh, it's down now.
Yeah, I know.
You got
two or three some.
We still operate the.
Yeah, there's train. It's quite a change.
A lot of the railroaders are interested in model air railroading and stuff like that. There's whole groups down in Portland that have build tracks.
Do they? Yeah, I've heard of them. I don't do that, but what I like to do, I like to go around. I'm more interested in going to these, like Sacramento. I went down there once to their steam fair where they brought in a lot of live steam locomotives and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I like to go do that. And I'll go to museums and look through stuff once in a while, but I never really got into the model portion of it.
Ever been over to Primeville to see the old shave that
no.
used to be?
No, I saw. No, that Shea was down there the time we were at Sacramento. I think it was 1999 we went down there because the UP brought both their steam engines down there, and then there was the Shea was there, and then Sumter brought their little wood burner down there. And I mean, it was all kinds of stuff. It was amazing to see all the different kinds of steam locomotives they had there. It was quite impressive. And they got a really good museum, railroad museum there in Sacramento. It's right there at that where they hold this.
That's what I've heard.
And it's in a big old, I think they got it from a Southern Pacific Terminal Roundhouse is what it is. And you go inside that thing and it's got some amazing steam locomotives in there. They've got the Southern Pacific design one that had the cab on the front, the steam one. And the reason there were so many tunnels going over, you know, the Sierras, that they couldn't see kind of the smoke.
Yeah.
So that was one of the reasons they did that. And this looks like we're going forward, but it looks like he's going the other way. Hey, he ought to be going the other way, but he's going forward with the cab on.
What do you think about the county allowing Union County buying the railroad up to Joseph?
Well, I can see in a way why they're doing it, and it'd be great if it worked, but I just have my reservations. I don't know whether how it's gonna work. I'd like to see it work, but in my own mind, I can't see it working. I don't think they can make any money at it, unless they had a steam engine, you know. But that'd be a calling card. And I don't know what they have in mind, because I don't think there's a revenue up there to get it. It's just like the articles you saw in the paper, and you know, you just can't. The UP would have kept it if it was making money. I think the county should have bought it for $25,000 like the Idaho Northern did, and they could sell it and make money. That's what the whole there.
Well, you know, we live right here in the hub of everything that would be so great, and it would help the community and everything else.
Well, you know, if you can get the tourism doing it, I guess more power to them, but I don't know. Now, I do know over there in Idaho, and I don't know whether I should be, how accurate I'd be right now today saying it, but I do know that they had Idaho Northern, there was a club over there in Boise, as I understood it, a railroad club, you know, a lot of railroad buffs. And anyway, they got this formed, and there was one engineer that was working for the Idaho Northern that was part of it. But anyway, they got this excursion train going from Casca, Idaho, down about 15 miles before they dropped down into the canyon. And I guess that every time they run it, it's full. And they've got about four coaches, and I don't know how many. But it's a kind of a pretty scene, you know, for the no more than it is. And then they got another one they run from Horseshoe Bend or maybe Emmett up to, I can't remember that other little place, but they manage it, but I don't know if they're making any money or how they do it.
It might be hard to do that.
Yeah.
When you were growing up here, did you hunt and fish?
Well, I hunted a little, but I never did a lot of fishing because I didn't have the patience to do it. And so I didn't get that way until I go with my dad, and he'd always get a basket full, and I was maybe have a little tougher time doing it, line tangling up, you know, so I thought, well, I had other fish to fry, you know. But he was quite a fisherman. But I wasn't until later on when I got married, and my father-in-law and then my dad, too, but we got into the fishing mode. We do quite a bit of
Where did you go?
Fishing. Well, we used to go down to Looking Glass. My father-in-law got me to go on down there, and when I was probably in, before I was about 25 years old, he's always liked to do hunting and fishing, so I did quite a bit with him, and they go down that Looking Glass. We'd hike in above Sophie Davis's cabin, and then we'd fish from there up to Eagle Creek, and it was a lot of fun. Nice sized trout, and at that time you could catch the bull trout. And every once in a while you'd see in the June, or if we was down there a time or two in July, and you could see, and I think the salmon, you could see them where they had something like a buried grab one and have part of the tour up on the bank, where you'd see them, and you could see them in the water, you know, dying. But but there wasn't a lot of them, but that you could see them.
Did you ever see them over in Catherine Creek?
When I went fishing with my dad when I was a kid, I'd go over there. I'd been with him a time or two, and he has been with him when he's caught them. Right out of Cat on a not too far this side of Union. I can't remember the exact place.
Probably out there on the Davis Ranch.
Yeah, it probably was. Yeah.
Where the dam was out there.
Out in that area someplace. And I've got pictures of my dad and my granddad. They'd probably fishing there somewhere, and they had caught salmon. And I can only judge by the year of the car they were standing by, but it had to be, I guess my dad was probably about 11 or 12 years old. And they was holding up salmon, and you know, and he wasn't. You know, it was all he could do to keep the tail off the ground. It was pretty good-sized salmon. And I went with my wife's dad one time up to Francis Lake. We hiked in, and we did a lot of fishing around, just different streams. I kind of like the stream fishing. Kind of a lot of fun to do to get out there and just get lost and get out there and walk down a stream and fish and not see anything. No. Oh, I have, but not very much.
We always like to take the trip up to Tawny Bays and then over the top to Granite and then to Sumter to Baker and then back to Grand.
Uh-huh.
So it's pretty dry in the fall.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it is.